Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we're offering five conversations from episode 11, in which Michael Charlton joins Jorn, Louise, and me for a far-ranging conversation of recent studies and highlights. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last year's EASL Congress wrap-up, offering some different thoughts about the role of MASH drugs as adjuvant therapies. This final conversation also is a bit of a grab bag. Starts by looking at how prescribing models for other diseases might work in MASH and MASL, shifting to a discussion of keeping patients enrolled in long-term clinical trials or even participating in trials in the first place as the landscape changes, and moves on to the final question for the episode. The conversation picks up on the question of how FGF21s might be prescribed alongside Rezdiffra. I start by asking whether the prescribing pattern might fit in an oncology model where FGF21 might be an induction drug and Rezdiffra a maintenance drug. Michael Charlton suggests the benefits from FGF21s are likely to fade once therapy is discontinued, which would make this model suboptimal. Jorn Schottenberg shifts to raise the question of keeping patients in long-term clinical trials necessary to achieve hard outcomes. Jorn advocates to keep his patients in trials, but notes that this will become increasingly challenging as more therapeutic options become available and the patient may not be approving, fear that they are on placebo and want to switch. Michael suggests we will find similar challenges in recruitment for new trials if patients have to accept the possibility of receiving a placebo, and I add that biopsy requirements in clinical trials, which are not necessary to prescribe Rezdiffra, may present an added hurdle. At this point, the episode winds down. I ask participants what they believe are exciting studies likely to come to light over the next several months. Their answers vary. You'll have to listen to learn. It's been a while since we did an episode with a guest where we simply talked about several issues we found important. So having Michael with us was great, and discussing these topics was fantastic. There's a lot here to think about in a lot of different topics, so just sit back, listen, learn, enjoy, and when you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group. Where I was going in my mind, we talked from time to time on this podcast about what are the ultimate therapy models or disease models for how we're going to use drugs to treat this disease. And one of the places you go to is oncology and really blood dyscrasias, where you've got induction drugs and you've got maintenance drugs. And the maintenance period could be the induction drug less frequently, or it could be a completely different set of medicines or some combination of the two. As eye-catching as the FGF21 numbers are, it's not clear to me you'd have to give that for that long a time, as long as you had a way to maintain progress using a drug that was easier to comply and less, you know, and less challenging.
Michael Charlton.
I agree. I don't know that you could either. The metabolic effects are so profound. And I think the same is true with the triple agonist. Once you start to get GLP-1, GIP, and then glucagon, the weight loss effects are so profound, you know, you're really inducing really substantial catabolism. I don't know how sustainable that will be beyond a year either. We'll see.
Well, interesting. One of the problems with the BMS drug was rebound, that after the wear-off of effect. We've now got longer studies with FGF21 that suggests that might not be the case, but that's the thing we're looking for, right?
Yes.
But now let me go back to your question about how do you measure efficacy with resmetirom. If it turned out that with FGF21s, you got your whole bang in, let's say, a year or 18 months or even 96 weeks, I guess is the longest looked at. After that, the benefit would stabilize, but the patient would rebound if you took them off the drug.
I think they probably would.
At that point, do we keep them on the drug to prevent from rebounding and then add therapies on top of that? Or we don't know, actually, right?
There's a long-term study, of course, that's ongoing where people continue drug. But my guess is because of the metabolic nature of this condition, that this will be at least a medium-term need. It'll be interesting to hear Jorn and Louise think.
Jorn Schottenberg.
Well, I would even say there's clearly a long-term need for treatment. So the challenge in the drug development sphere here and the challenges we've been discussing with the FDA is it takes so long to reach hard outcomes in these type of trials enrolling patients in the F2, F3 space. And that's why we're stuck with all these surrogates. Quality of life was mentioned earlier. Didn't really make a big difference for this MOA here. I mean, even for the ongoing trial, there's going to be the complexity. Some people dropping out, some of the comorbidities being treated with drugs that might affect the disease course. So it's a high bar still. And I'm clearly pushing all the patients I'm seeing or suggesting and counseling that way to stay on drugs, stay on the trial to actually generate that data set. It might be tougher and tougher down the line because we're going to have more drugs coming into the market, more patients wanting to have access to these drugs versus an RCT. I'm hoping for the best, but it's going to be a challenging trial moving forward and continuing this.
That's a great. Let's just say you're a stage 3 patient. You have F3 disease and you're newly diagnosed and you Google it. You see what stage 3 means, that it's close to F4. And then you're presented with a clinical trial where you may get placebo for 12 or 18 months. Is it going to be harder to enroll now that we have an oral therapy that's effective? You know, are placebos going to be something that feature in phase 2b studies, or is the comparator going to become resmetirom. That's not something that we really had to address up to this point, but I think it's similar to inflammatory bowel disease studies where no one's on placebo. You're either on standard of therapy plus minus some other thing.
I think you have to account for it. You can't make it standard of care in my understanding as long as it's not a conditional approval. So that's the challenge here again, but I agree it will hamper drug development a little bit for the best of the patient, support them getting effective drugs.
This is an episode I want to do soon, and Michael, if you want to join it, I'll do it on a day that you said you might be available. That's issue number one around Kleiser, and the other one obviously is the only reason you need to get a biopsy anymore is if you're going into a clinical trial.
Or if you're the disease. You may be this bit of some autoimmune markers.
Yeah, but
or,
to your F3 patient who knows that he or she is an F3 patient, right? Now I can get the prescription and watch the progress of my disease and never have to mess with a biopsy. Or I can go into a clinical trial where I'm going to get my liver stuck twice. And by the way, I might be on a placebo. In fact, I was having this conversation with Mike Patel in episode 8, that for the patient, it becomes an increasingly unattractive proposition to be in a clinical trial, which is unfortunate because we need patients in clinical trials. And ideally, we shouldn't just have the ones who are deemed to have failed resmetirom, particularly if, Michael, if we're using your definition of failure, which is if the patient doesn't progress, they're a success.
Actually, one of the interesting things, and I hate to go back to Hep C space again, but in the Hep C days, one of the consistent themes was that centers in Texas were super enrollers in Hep C studies. And the reason is they have the worst access to healthcare in the United States. So they have a very high uninsured rate. So if you wanted to get treatment for your Hep C, one of the best ways to get it when it was reasonably restricted was to be uninsured, but in a clinical trial. For things like the GLP-1 receptor agonists that can be hard to get a hold of, I think those will continue to be attractive. But I think for a new MOA with any sort of side effect concern, I think it will be more difficult than it has been up to this point.
Yeah, a concern I share.
Louise Campbell.
I was just going to say on Michael's point earlier about non-progression, I think as we see more and more that these people put on the F3s, if we can slow down and really see that lack of progression to cirrhosis, then we have that complete argument of not to carry on. And once we start to see that slowing, we will need a number of patients on to sort of do that over time. But that's where we will get that real data of cost effectivity. It's reducing transplant lists. But that's going to take a long time to generate that data on the average rate of progression from an F3 to an F4. My one question that I was going to ask, HCC surveillance in this population of the F3s, because we know that muscles incurs a HCC increased risk because you do not have to have cirrhosis. What are the plans for HCC monitoring in these patients? Is there a particular format designed like for the cirrhotic population that we know, say the Hep C's, the ALDs, things like that. How are people addressing that?
About a third of F3s or F4 in reality. So if I have somebody who the biopsy showed bridging fibrosis, but maybe they have any thrombocytopenia, I will get 6 monthly ultrasounds in that patient.
All right. We're at the bottom of the hour, so it's not a bit of time to wrap up. Michael, something that you're looking at in the world that we'll see in the next 3 months that people should be on the lookout for that you haven't mentioned yet?
Gosh, I'm going to say it's going to be the first combination study of something with resmetirom in a prospective study. We've heard things about there were patients who were already on a GLP-1 RA in the Maestro-NASH study, data in a Caro study about, they actually deliberately had a GLP-1 lead-in as well. It didn't seem to make much difference. But I'm looking for a really interesting combination study. I know that there are several out there that should be reporting between EASL and ASLD. So I'm really excited for those.
Where everything works, huh? Because, I mean, there was a late breaker at ASLD, which was a combination of an FXR and a THR-beta, and what they proved is that the THR-beta was fine in combination, but the FXR had no value.
Exactly.
And then Turns decided to exit MASH for a while. Joran, anything you've been hearing about in your scanning of papers or the German meeting?
Well, I'm looping back to the conversation we had with Hannes Hagström last week, and they, under the leadership of Winston Wong, some European and Asian U.S. Collaborators, really generated a large group of NITs, follow-up data around VCTE, and they promised more data to be shared from that large cohort. So I think we'll see more from that realm. And then, of course, big studies kicking off to prove the worth of screening in at-risk populations. There'll be more activities, particularly around NITs, understanding treatment response, but also screening starting this second half of the year that I'm very much looking forward to.
Louise?
No, only thing that's happened this week, we've got ethics approval on a big trial, which means we can look at starting scanning on, that's over 1,000 patients to get done. So that's good. But obviously, I can't reveal any of that yet.
Which will produce fantastic data.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded the conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We're working on next week's topic, but it will be at least as good as this week's, maybe even better. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.